You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. When schools shifted back to in-person learning last school year, many families were relieved to have their kids back in classrooms, but for some, virtual learning really worked well. As Madeline Fox reports, some Wisconsin districts responded by creating or expanding virtual schooling that they expect will last even after the pandemic is over.
LB is a second grader at the Racine School District's virtual program. She goes by LB at school, and her family asked not to use her last name out of privacy concerns. She initially went virtual because her younger brother is at higher risk for COVID-19, but the family found that she's thriving in virtual school.
I love it because virtual is like my friend.
Racine had a virtual learning program before the pandemic, but it was mostly used in special cases. Students with medical issues who would miss too much school in person, or athletes and performers who traveled a lot and needed to keep up with schoolwork. Now, there are 660 students enrolled virtually full-time in grades K through 12, more than triple last year's enrollment. They have regular classes as well as gym, music, and art online.
I just like to make noise.
The school sent home kits for students to participate in music class. LB is thriving virtually, but that wasn't a common experience when most students had to learn virtually in the early pandemic. Students without regular internet access struggled to connect. Older students sometimes had to help their younger siblings through lessons, which meant their own studies fell by the wayside. And many just don't feel engaged when they're learning through a screen. But it was ideal for some. For students on the autism spectrum, it can be reassuring to have the distance and control of learning through a screen instead of the overstimulation of a classroom setting. Separation from a classroom also often works better for kids who are being bullied.
I think of one of our families who the son has an IEP.
TJ McCray is in charge of Madison Promise, the district's new virtual program. An IEP, or an individualized education plan, is a plan for students with special needs.
During pandemic, the student really excelled. Mom got him on a virtual program, and we're really seeing some progress with that student.
While Racine had an existing program it could modify, Madison Promise is a new virtual program started this school year. Milwaukee and Green Bay created similar programs.
We were all afraid that we would be recognized as being like the COVID school, and that was never the intention.
Tanya Sioni teaches third grade in Green Bay's virtual program.
The intention was that people were coming here because it's what they needed for their lifestyle, or because it was a choice that they were making, not something that they felt like they had to do because they had no other choices.
She says that while some students did go back once they got vaccinated, a lot are planning to return to virtual next school year for reasons that have nothing to do with COVID. The Green Bay School District even built classrooms for virtual teachers that are outfitted with cameras, microphones, and other tools to make it easier to teach. Madison Promise has a timeline to add more classrooms for different ages. Virtual charter schools, which handled most of the state's online learners before the pandemic, have grown, and 9 new ones have opened in Wisconsin in the past 2 years. A 2021 survey by the RAND Corporation found that about 11% of families didn't want to sit their kids back in person, but the survey was done before vaccines were available for kids under 12. All 7 of Deborah White's kids are learning virtually this year.
We tend to get sick, not all together, but one at a time. So I just feel like it was the most convenient thing for my family at the time because we have so many small people in the house.
But they mostly want to return in person, like Taylor, age 9.
When I do virtual, I don't be focused. But when I do in person, I be totally focused.
Virtual learning wasn't optional for many schools in the first year or more of the pandemic. But enough students found that it worked well for them that they want to stick with it. And schools are responding by building new programs for them. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, closing arguments are scheduled tomorrow in a case that's gotten a lot of attention in a wide variety of both news outlets and social media platforms. Actor Johnny Depp sued his ex-wife, actor Amber Heard, for defamation. The lawsuit is based on a 2018 opinion piece she wrote for the Washington Post about being a survivor of domestic abuse. Depp argued that while the piece didn't name him specifically, it still caused damage to his reputation and career. Regardless of the outcome, some experts on sexual and domestic violence are worried about the effects it could have on victims of abuse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following this week's long trial, avoiding it, or seeing news about it, even if you were trying to avoid it? what has stood out to you about the coverage. If you have dealt with issues of domestic violence in your own life, what does this all say to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nicole Badera is a sociologist who focuses on gender-based violence. She recently completed her PhD at the University of Michigan, where she studied college sexual assault. Nicole, welcome to Central Time.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into specific, takeaways from this trial that you might be worried about, this is a really a weird thing. We're like nationwide, worldwide, people are watching this case unfold in real time, picking sides, doing things on social media and TikTok to support one person in this or another. It seems like it'd be hard to get a good message out of this sort of media circus approach. What do you think about that?
Yeah, this has been a really unusual case because of the amount of attention it has gotten and what attention that has been. So usually if we know a case is going to be high profile, you'll see coverage in big mainstream media platforms like NPR or the New York Times or places like that. But this case at the beginning was treated like more of a celebrity tabloid issue. And the people who originally took up the helm to discuss it were people like TikTok influencers or podcasters that stream to YouTube. And these people didn't necessarily have a lot of expertise on the subject of gender-based violence. And as a result, there's been a lot of misinformation spreading about the trial and about how to make sense of intimate partner violence in general.
And what are some of your biggest worries when it comes to misleading messages people could get, especially when it comes to intimate partner violence?
There's already a lot of misinformation about intimate partner violence, and it has a lot of really predictable outcomes. One that's very alarming is that when we dismiss survivors' true stories of intimate partner violence and we scrutinize and criticize them, it can be more difficult for victims who are currently in violent relationships to see the violence they're experiencing as wrong. And so they might stay longer if they identify with Amber Heard's story and they start to think to themselves, is what I'm going through really that bad? So that's one obvious one. Another one is that when survivors do come forward, their friends and family might be more likely to victim blame them. They might be more likely to question whether there was really abuse, and that can be harmful too. And then something unique about this particular case is that Amber Heard did not name a perpetrator when she identified as a survivor. And that can lead a lot of survivors to wonder, will I face a defamation case if I advocate for sexual violence or intimate partner violence? Could I be the one who's going to face this kind of punishment next?
That's something I've seen as a concern, that defamation cases, whether they're successful or not, could be used as a tactic to prevent victims of intimate partner violence from coming forward. Is this a concern, or do you think this is something that's going to be unique to this particular high-profile case?
It is a concern, in part because we already know that it's not unique. So my background is mostly in campus sexual violence. And in that setting, 23% of survivors that report to their universities face the threat of a defamation lawsuit from their perpetrators. Now, I want to say it doesn't matter if those defamation lawsuits are successful. It doesn't matter if the victim would ultimately win in the end. They're still expensive and they're scary. And one thing that we should always keep in mind is they do force prolonged contact between victim and perpetrator. So in this case, for example, Amber Heard left her relationship with Johnny Depp years ago. She left in 2016, and now they've had to spend 6 weeks next to each other every day in the same courtroom. So in that way, these defamation cases, regardless of their outcome, can become an extension of a perpetrator's abuse. And then when you add the social media frenzy in this kind of a high profile case, then they can be used to punish, harass, and humiliate victims too.
In the social media frenzy that you mentioned, a lot of the detailed fine point sorts of things seem to be people analyzing Amber Heard's demeanor, performance, how she's presenting herself, and trying to read and glean from that if her case, if her accusations of domestic violence are authentic or not. This idea of somebody having to be in some ways the phrase is the perfect victim in a courtroom. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I think it's really striking that there is a lot of attention to these fine details. And that's sort of a trope in crime shows, including true crime shows, we love some kind of a crime drama that ends with that one piece of evidence that looked irrelevant cracking the case. But in reality, this type of irrelevant evidence can be really damaging, especially in gender-based violence trials where there is so much misinformation and so much misunderstanding about victims' behavior. So that's where we run into the problems of the perfect victim trope, where there's no such thing as a perfect victim. The whole point of this trope is that no victim can live up to it, that everyone will break the rules of how you should behave at some point. And that's because they're contradictory. This is actually what my very first study I ever conducted was on, was about how all of the rules women are supposed to follow about how to be a victim and how to prevent violence contradict one another, which makes it impossible to fit into the stereotype. And so you see that on display with how Amber Heard is being criticized, that she's crying too much or she's not crying enough is a really good example of how her behavior is being picked apart, while Johnny Depp is not being held to the same standard.
We're talking to sociologist Nicole Badera about gender-based violence, her concerns about this high-profile Johnny Depp defamation suit against Amber Heard over her writing about being a domestic abuse survivor without naming him. That trial wrapping up this week. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you following this story? How is it impacting you? Is it dredging up maybe personal experiences for you? Do you have questions about how these kind of cases are handled in the court? Are you worried about the social mediaization, if I can make that word up, and how it affects what we're learning or think we're learning from this trial? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk about the defamation trial involving actors and former spouses Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. Central to this, accusations of domestic abuse, intimate partner violence. Even if you haven't wanted to follow this case, it is getting a lot of coverage, a lot of coverage on social media in particular. Sociologist Nicole Badera is our guest. We're talking about the impacts this high-profile trial could have on abusers and on victims of gender-based violence. You can join the conversation with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Nicole, I've seen concerns out there that some people are actively promoting this on social media with particular messages, trying to call claims of domestic abuse into question in the first place. Is that a concern you have?
Yeah, it's something that we've seen a lot. Some of the most popular hashtags that have been dominating the social media discussion have been questioning what domestic abuse even is and whether or not it's fair for women to say that they've experienced domestic abuse. And I want to point out that a lot of the social media response has just been really misogynist. That if you look at the types of ways that Amber Heard is being talked about, the language isn't very kind, to say the least. And it's based off of these old tropes that women who make allegations of intimate partner violence are liars or psychopaths. And so it's really important that when you do see these gendered tropes come up, that you give them a little bit more thought and you start to think, how is gender inequality shaping this broader conversation?
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for this conversation. I think it's really informative to learn about these things. My comment is kind of two parts. One, just reflecting the social media aspect, I frequent Reddit, and the number of references that I've seen, it's really disappointing to see how quick people are to disbelieve or disparage things that Amber Heard says or does, and how quick they are to just blindly accept things that Johnny Depp has said. And it's just been disappointingly one-sided. The other thing I was going to say, and I'll make this short, the professor, you had mentioned something about contradictory standards that women are expected to conform to. And in a recent course that I took, Women in Literature, you can look back hundreds of years at things women have wrote and see that these sorts of contradictory standards that are at odds with each other and are punishing to women and their freedom and their expression have been around for way too long. And this is just kind of one new way that you see that.
Michael, thanks for the call. Nicole, what do you think?
Yeah, I think you're picking up on something that has happened for a very long time. And part of what's disappointing in this moment is we thought that the Me Too movement would have helped protect against some of these myths. But I think one of the reasons that these double standards are persisting is because of who the original audience for this case was. It blew up on TikTok. And so if you think about who in your own family is the most likely to be on TikTok, I know in mine, it's some of the teenagers who are actually too young to really be aware of the Me Too movement at its peak. And so one thing the Me Too movement did not successfully do was promote a lot of structural changes, including instilling education on what intimate partner violence is and how to support victims into our formal education systems. So a lot of people who are seeing this stuff, they don't know any better still. And we really, one thing we can take away from this case is how important it is to create structural change to make sure that everybody is getting the information about how to recognize violence when it's happening and how to support victims when it does.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Susan next in Rhinelander. Susan, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to offer that I took in a few snippets of the coverage and I immediately had a sense that not only did it seem very tragic on both sides, but that it was an invasion of privacy. It almost felt unseemly for me to watch it. So that was enough for me. But also, you're just looking at the, intrinsically, an older man with a much younger woman in the relationship. He comes into it with a lot of power and financial resources. And the little bit that I saw where he was testifying, it almost felt like that he was not taking it seriously, or that there was some almost a comic undertone. Hard to pinpoint, but that was my sense in just the little bit that I saw.
Well, Susan, I felt the same way in watching a little bit to prepare for the show today. It felt very voyeuristic to watch it in the first place. Nicole, does it do us any good to have this out there in the public? I know legally cameras can be in the courtroom there, but I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think it does. One of my big takeaways from this case is that we should increase protections for this type of a court case, because we know that predictably when we have cases of gender-based violence that get this kind of scrutiny or a live stream, that it can lead to a lot of harassment of the victim. And there isn't a lot of protection in place to keep that from happening. In fact, this defamation case naming Amber Heard has led her to be quite defamed. And I'll say that I do agree, and I've heard a lot of people who've actually watched the case themselves say that that's kind of the impression they've gotten about Johnny Depp's behavior, that the coverage that's happening on social media is really disassociated from what's happening in the courtroom, and people who do watch some of it for themselves are really shocked to see what's going on.
Susan, thanks for the call. Tom joins us now in Brookfield. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'd like to bring up the point that the inequality there is when it comes to cases like this, where Amber herself has admitted to hitting Johnny. And when Johnny is upset and cries, she makes fun of him and just degrades his manhood. It's a very one-sided argument, and I don't like how nobody pays attention to when the woman abuses the man, but everyone cares about it when it's the other way around.
Tom, thanks for the call. Nicole, Tom feels like there's a double standard for men and women when it comes to intimate partner abuse.
Yeah, I think that this is a really important point to be able to address, because this comes up a lot. Johnny Depp has made allegations that that Amber Heard was the true abuser. And the reality is that this is something that happens to victims of intimate partner violence a lot if they use violence as a form of self-defense, which when you think about it in any other context, if you're being violently attacked, you would expect someone to defend themselves. But this has led to a lot of confusion and misinformation around what intimate partner violence is and who the victims are. One thing I want everybody to take away from this case is that the context of violence matters. Whether or not someone is responding out of fear versus trying to control matters. And We have a lot of work to do on this. For example, in my own field of social science, we've made some mistakes in the past where we've used surveys to gauge who victims are in intimate partner violence relationships that were completely neutral and didn't take context into account. And so we would ask, has your partner hit you, for example? And when you do it that way, it actually looks like men are more likely to be victims than women. But that's because women are unlikely to say that they have been hit by a partner if they were acting in self-defense. And so you were capturing men who were claiming to be victims when they were both perpetrators and victims. And that's one of the complexities moving forward. Context is really important. There's a difference between aggression and self-defense.
Nicole, thanks for the call, Tom. And just our last minute, Nicole, what are you hoping that people can take away from a trial like this?
Something that I think is really crucial is that we do need to make more structural changes to support the Me Too movement. Since we haven't changed the legal system that so commonly betrays survivors, it's going to continue to do so. And so it's time for some serious reforms. And then the other thing that I think is most important is to make sure that we are protecting survivors' freedom of speech. It is so crucial that survivors can talk about what has happened to them.
Nicole, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Nicole Badera is a sociologist who studies gender-based violence. She was with us today to talk about some wider concerns she has coming out of the high-profile defamation trial involving actors and ex-spouses Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. Resources out there. The National Domestic Violence Hotline phone number is 1-800-799-7233. That's 1-800-799-7233 for the National Domestic Violence Hotline. The National Dating Abuse Helpline number is 1-866-331-9474. Again, 866-331-9474, or you can text LOVEIS to 22522. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, another string of mass shootings is pointing attention back at gun laws as the NRA meets this weekend in Texas. We'll look at the latest in the politics of gun regulation. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the Great Resignation has been a wild time for many workers and employers, but it'll all go back to normal eventually, right? A business journalist says maybe not and makes the case it's time to start preparing for a forever resignation. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a million people in the U.S. have died of COVID-19 as of last week. A Wisconsin philosopher who studies trauma tells us why it can be hard to make sense of the scale of loss caused by the pandemic. First, job openings in the U.S. continue to be at record levels, and the number of workers quitting their jobs is too. The labor market shift has been called the Great Resignation. According to a recent report from the research firm Gartner, it may be a permanent change in many fields instead of a temporary one. Our next guest recently took a closer look at that research and spent some time thinking about what the forever resignation could mean for employers and workers. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Have you quit a job during the pandemic to find something new, to retire maybe earlier than you planned? Did you stay within a field or did you reevaluate the whole thing and go into something different? Employers, are you still seeing lots of turnover? How would you feel if things stayed this way and didn't go back to normal? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Aki Ito is a senior correspondent at Business Insider. She covers the economy, the labor market, and workplaces. Aki, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Can you tell us some more about this report predicting higher workplace turnover, maybe for the long run here?
Sure. So I think, you know, every employer in America right now is staring at very, very high attrition rates. And they're all wondering, when is this going to end? And I think most of them are expecting it to end at some point. You know, it's just around the corner. Everything's going to go back to the pre-pandemic normal very soon. But this new report from the research firm Gartner predicts that we're never going to go back to that pre-pandemic normal. They estimate that voluntary turnover is going to be 20% higher than it was before the pandemic. And that's a big shift, you know, in a large company with let's say 25,000 employees, that means an additional 1,000 people would be quitting every year compared to what the quitting rate was before the pandemic.
Now, this may look different from industry to industry. A lot of your recent piece on this, Aki, looks at white collar jobs in particular. What are some of the things that have been happening in that sector that's making them think, yeah, maybe this keeps going?
The number one thing is the increase in remote work. And nobody thinks that we're going back to the kind of in-person, in-office work that we had before the pandemic. That's the one thing that we're always going to keep. And as a result, that means, you know, we're going to see some changes in the way that the job market actually functions. Remote work is important for attrition for two reasons. One is that in a remote environment, workers feel less attached to their jobs because they feel less attached to their colleagues. That was traditionally something that kept them from resigning, even if the job wasn't good for them or the pay wasn't great. The second factor with remote work is that you just have so many more options than before because you're no longer limited to your local job market. And that means that with more options, workers are more likely to quit to go to a different employer. And that once again elevates the attrition rate too.
Right. Did I see you quoted somebody who's working in Baltimore, not seeing jobs they'd want to switch to in their neighborhood, but they could remote work for a company they liked in London?
Yeah, all the way across the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah, and that is part of what's driving people to seek jobs. I can search the job market and I don't have to go to them if I don't want to.
And this is a really important point here is that it permanently gives more power to workers. You know, the more options you have, the more bargaining power you have, you know, the more likely you'll be able to find a job that's good for you. So this is all around great news for workers.
Now, obviously, this isn't remote work isn't an option in all lines of work. A lot of service type jobs and manufacturing, things like that, you got to go there. Are there thoughts in the industry, though, that at least some of this resignation trend will continue even in work in person places?
It's very possible. I mean, some of the highest quitting rates that we're seeing across the country are in leisure and hospitality jobs, the majority of which are in-person jobs. So that we could keep seeing that for a long time as well. But it wouldn't be related to this increase in remote work that we're seeing in white collar professional jobs.
We're talking to Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider. She covers the economy and the labor market. We're looking at this big trend. We've talked about it on the show before. A lot more people than usual quitting their jobs, often to take on a new job or start a new career or maybe retire early. Want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Have you quit a job, changed a job, worked remotely for a new employer lately, or do you like where you are and you're sticking with it? Love to hear from people from a variety of types of jobs, whether you have left a service sector job, white collar, blue collar, you name it. Call in at 800-642-1234. And employers love to hear what you're seeing if you're trying to hire people and retain people. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Aki, what are businesses, and again, you focus on the white collar world here, what are businesses trying to do to keep the people they've already got?
Sure. So, you know, there are some executives right now that are pushing to go back into the office because they know that in a remote environment, you know, employees don't feel as attached to their colleagues. And as a result, they're more likely to leave. They think that, you know, forcing everybody back into the office is a great retention plan. And, you know, that actually, you know, most likely will make things worse because people have so many options now. You know, they can go to other employers that are offering work from home options or hybrid options. So that would probably backfire. But the thing that employers really need to do is to try to, you know, build that camaraderie in the workplace, even if employees are working remotely or working hybrid, both from home and the office. It's harder to do than when you're in the office 5 days a week, but it's not impossible. And the second thing is employers are going to have to hire a lot more recruiters just because, you know, in the age of the forever resignation, there are just going to be a lot more jobs to fill. And it probably also means that employers are going to have to hire more people across the board so that they're, you know, not constantly, they have more backups, you know, to come in when somebody leaves. If more people are going to be leaving constantly, that means that you have to staff up a little bit more to make sure that you can absorb those shocks.
We heard from Mary on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who writes, "The company I work at has grown since COVID started. They increased starting wages to entice applicants and updated the pay scale to incentivize / reward existing employees." Mary adds, "While we lost some people due to regular turnover, a few from burnout during COVID, the overall headcount keeps increasing." That two-part thing there she mentioned, Aki, offering more pay to those new employees and at the same time bumping up the pay to keep existing employees. That sounds like it's been a hurdle for some places. They've done that first part, maybe lost people who are jealous of those new employees getting paid more than they were.
Yeah, I actually just wrote a story about this, and I think it really hit a nerve because I think these employers who've, you know, stuck around at their companies for a long time are seeing these new hires come in at much higher salaries than what they're earning. It sounds like, you know, the Facebook user who posted to your site, you know, their employer has been proactive and actually has raised wages for existing employees too. Companies that are proactive like that aren't going to see the kind of attrition rates that other companies that are less proactive are seeing right now, because they're, you know, going out of their way to try to retain those existing employees. And, you know, probably in the short term, it seems more expensive, but in the long run, by keeping their talented employees, I bet it's ultimately a cost-saving measure.
It's Brianna Caller now at 800-642-1234. Amy is with us in Ozaukee County. Amy, hi.
Hi. I was calling. I retired early from my job because I was really working really, really, really long hours. I mean, I love my job, and I was doing more work. There wasn't as many employees, and it was very stressful. So I decided to retire early. I think the management was not good. Poor management. So, I retired early, and I really didn't want to because I love my job. So,
Amy, do you have thoughts of going back into the workforce? Obviously, probably not for the same company.
Yes, I do. I am retired, but I do have another job, and it's a lot less stressful, and I'm a caregiver,
excellent.
So for an elderly woman, so it's, you know, it's a lot less stressful, and in a lot of ways, you know, it's pretty rewarding.
Excellent, Amy. Thanks so much, Aki. A couple things there. I think there's been in some workplaces the idea that you got to work the long hours, like it or lump it. The competition's going to offer the same. Workers like Amy may not put up with that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, we saw a lot of that, especially during the pandemic. After the initial layoffs in the steep recession at the beginning of the pandemic, there were fewer people around to do the same amount of work or even more work. So many people got burned out. We're still seeing that now. A lot of people, you know, left their companies, or they may have left the workforce for good, as was probably initially the case for Amy. We're actually seeing older workers now come back out of retirement now. It's a trend that's called unretirement. It sounds like that's what Amy did as well. And, you know, I'm so happy to hear about her experience because, you know, she went from a really stressful job to a less stressful job. She went to a job that feels more rewarding. And that's amazing. You know, that's exactly the kind of, you know, the kind of transitions that you like to see in a hot job market, the kind of hot job market that we are seeing right now.
Amy, thanks for that call. We're talking to Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider, with us today to talk about the still ongoing great resignation, more people than usual leaving their jobs for one reason or another, the possibility that at least in some lines of work, it could turn into a forever resignation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Did you change jobs during the pandemic? Are you thinking about making a switch now? What's driving that, or what's driving you to stay in your line of work, your career? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 if you're an employee or employer. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about the Great Resignation still going strong and why some analysts think high turnover may become the norm in some jobs anyway. Aki Ito with Business Insider has been writing about it, stays with us now, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your own experiences deciding to switch a job, leave a job, or stay on the job, or trying to convince people to work for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Scott joins us in Appleton. Hi, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me on. My question and stuff is more of what are companies doing if they're changing how they're treating their employees? Are they starting to treat their employees more so like people, or is it still continuing the, oh, I'm just a number to kind of mentality?
Scott, interesting question. Aki, is there some of what Scott's looking for there, treating employees, he says, more like people?
Anecdotally, from workers in all kinds of different industries, you know, not every company is able to compete with, you know, these sky high salaries that we're seeing in the market right now. And so as a result, they're trying to pull on other levers to, you know, make their workplace more attractive to new hires and also to existing employees too. One of the best ways to do that is just to build a better culture, right? To, you know, get rid of the toxic bosses and to make the workplace just a more humane place, less burnout, that kind of thing. So I'm absolutely hearing that on the ground.
I mean, that sounds easy to do. Is it really easy to do if you've built up a work culture for 5, 10, 20 years?
Probably not, especially, you know, if, you know, you have a remote workplace now and you have less interaction amongst colleagues. But it's a huge priority for companies. And, you know, there's nothing that is more alarming to executives than these really high resignation rates right now. It's one thing to get complaints from employees, but if your best employees leave you altogether, nothing screams, you know, we need to make a change the way that those numbers do.
Scott, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard from Tom in Milwaukee. You couldn't stay on the line. Tom's seeing a renewed interest in labor unions out there, wonders if there's a link to this maybe more power in the hands of workers being able to move from one job to another. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is the hot job market and the increased bargaining power that workers are having is a key reason that we're seeing such high collective bargaining rates. Certainly unionization in the U.S. is still very low compared to what it used to be before and compared to other advanced countries. But we're seeing this real resurgence in unions. And I think a big part of that is because workers feel more empowered right now than they have been in a really long time.
Now, there's fears that a recession could, I mean, eventually a recession will come along again. I think that's the way the economy works. Fears that it could be, you know, next year or something. Are there thoughts that this conversation we're having now will be obsolete once a recession hits and maybe that's going to tighten things up and lower the options for these workers?
Sure. So, you know, certainly if a recession does come, you know, the labor market isn't going to be as hot as we're seeing right now. And as a result, I think the resignation rates are going to come down somewhat. But even in that pit of recession, I really, you know, Gartner is arguing that we're never going to see the kind of low quit rates that we saw in the 2010s before the pandemic. We're never going to see that again because even in a recession, we're still going to have a lot more remote work than we did before. And that just permanently changes the way that the labor market operates.
Now, we heard from Karen in Green Bay, who said she hopes companies turn to remote work and keep older employees who have a lot of knowledge. Is there a thought, Aki, that that's a good target for employers, their current older employees, or maybe people who have left other jobs, that that could be a source to fill these gaps they need?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly sounds like a good idea to me. We've actually heard of the opposite, too, that there's quite a bit of ageism in the labor market. A lot of people who are, you know, maybe over 50 don't even want to disclose their ages because they seem less employable. And if it is the case that companies are hiring more older workers, I think that's fantastic. In a really hot labor market, the kind of workers that are traditionally, you know, less attractive to work to employers, including, you know, people of color, people with criminal backgrounds, and probably older workers too, the kind of workers who get discriminated against in the in traditional labor markets, employers kind of start to hire from those pockets as well, because, you know, they have no choice but to. And that's really great for, you know, the entire economy. That's exactly what you want to see in an economic expansion.
Aki Ito is with us from Business Insider. She recently wrote about the Great Resignation and whether it's going to keep going on well into the future, especially in some industries. Still time for your calls with your experiences or questions at 800-642-1234. Jean joins us now in Milwaukee. Jean, hi.
Hi. I just was calling in to let you know that I lost my job from acquisition during COVID, and I figured out how to reduce my lifestyle to stay retired, and so I wanted to make you aware of that. And then also I had a question how you're saying that the job market makes it better for U.S. citizens to negotiate pay, but I would think that it would also make employees, potential employees from India or other countries to also try to get a job here.
Gotcha. Gene, we don't have too much time left. So a couple of things there, Aki. Let's start with that second point first. I've seen some people in the business world say, hey, we're having trouble hiring people, especially in certain jobs. Is anybody trying to make it easier for people from other countries to get those jobs?
I think we are starting to hear of employers hiring overseas too, kind of an offshoring of knowledge work as well. I haven't heard about it too much because I think there's a lot of kind of tax complications and employment law complications related to that. But I am hearing that, and that will probably be a much bigger concern down the road as, you know, companies get a lot more used to remote work. If you can, you know, if you're a company based in New York City and, you know, you can hire somebody, you know, in Nevada, let's say, what's stopping you from hiring somebody all the way in India, you know, who has an even lower cost of living? But I'm not hearing about it too much so far.
And Jean's personal experience was interesting. She lost her job because of an acquisition. Bad news. But then she says she downsized her retirement expectations and is cool with retirement now. And I mean, I've heard anecdotally, Aki, that that was something happening with workers who retired a little bit earlier than planned. They just kind of adjusted their retirement lifestyle expectations.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's great to hear that she was able to make it work and, mm-hmm. you know, she can stay retired now. I wish I were retired too. I have many decades ahead of me before that's going to be a financial feasibility for myself. But I do think, you know, one thing that's complicating that picture right now is inflation. You know, a lot more people are coming out of retirement right now because, you know, they just can't rely on their fixed income. It just doesn't make up for the amount of inflation that we're seeing right now. So that's one thing to keep an eye out on as well.
Aki, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me on. This was great.
We've been talking to Aki Ito, senior correspondent at Business Insider, who covers the economy, the labor market, and workplaces. She was with us today to talk about why some analysts think the Great Resignation, a lot of people leaving jobs, switching jobs, retiring early, why that may not end anytime soon, what that could mean for workers and businesses. Still time for you to share your thoughts on that and maybe your own experience. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, a Wisconsin philosopher joins the show to talk about community grief and trauma after the COVID-19 death toll crossed 1 million in the U.S. last week. Remember, you can follow these conversations all day, every day at WPR.org. Listen live or check out archive conversations or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app and listen wherever you go. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.